It's also an interesting contrast that he is, at this point, determined to stay on as party leader, whereas Jagmeet Singh has, well, stepped down immediately. I think before his seat was even officially called as having been lost. And I think that will also play into how their reputations age. I mean, it depends if Polyev is able to maintain control as Conservative Party leader and win a seat in a by-election, maybe, and move forward. Maybe that changes. But I think, you know, the perception of Jagmeet Singh had soured a little bit, which I think, as you mentioned, just might just be an expiration date type of thing. But I think that by sort of falling on his sword, as it were, and really in the last few days of the campaign, kind of saying that people should be, you know, voting strategically, and that he didn't mind that not calling for an earlier election where the NDP might have had a chance to be, you know, the NDP and the Liberals' fates could very easily have been swapped here if the election had been called earlier. Polling was showing that it might be the Liberals at risk of losing official party status as opposed to the NDP. By delaying that and denying the Conservatives what looked like a clear shot at a majority and sort of sacrificing his own party and his leadership of that party to do so, I think that might reflect well on him with the benefit of hindsight.
Mm-hmm. I think that was a talking point that he kind of shied away from during the initial period of the campaign, but near the end, when sort of the fate of the NDP seemed clearer and clearer, he essentially did admit that he was putting the Conservatives losing over the fate of his own party.
Which I think is reflective of the attitudes of a lot of progressive-leaning Canadians. I think that particularly with Polyev in charge and the sort of Trump MAGA alignment, or at least perceived alignment, that voters really, really wanted to avoid that. I think, you know, it's been said a lot that, you know, if Mark Carney had run as leader of the Conservatives, they would have won. And a lot of progressive voters would have been much less worried about letting that kind of Conservative government have power. Whereas seeing what's happening in the United States with that sort of mindset, and social programs being cut and all of that, was a pretty strong motivator for voters, I think.
Absolutely. I would agree with that.
And I think the fact that has dominated our conversation today, like, we haven't talked about policy at all. And I also feel like during most of the election, that was the case, you know, for better or for worse. This election was about dealing with what is perceived by some as an existential threat to the country and our way of life, and to others is seen as a distraction and something not to be concerned about. And that's what decided this election, as opposed to, you know, who had the best housing policy, climate policy, etc.
Yeah, I think that was one thing that I heard echoed, not just within, you know, circles that I'm in, but also on the election stream that we were a part of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just this idea that, you know, very existential issues that we're also dealing with, such as climate change, such as housing affordability and availability within Canada, were sort of put on the back burner. You know, like, actual policy issues within Canada were not the deciding factor in a lot of people's votes this election. And it'll be interesting, especially with the Liberals now with a minority government. It's yet to be seen whether they form coalition or anything like that. Minority governments often don't last the full 4 years. It'll be interesting what they can get accomplished within the amount of time that they're in government, and I guess what those central issues are going to be going forward.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see who the Liberals choose to work with, if they choose to do it on sort of a case-by-case basis, because they can work with The NDP, they have the required number of seats to pass anything. You could work with the Bloc Québécois on specific things. They could work with the Conservatives on certain things they might agree on. So there are sort of lots of paths forward. And personally, I don't mind seeing a minority government. I think compromise is good, usually. And it does potentially bring instability, right? But it can also mean that, you know, again, in the last parliament, lots of great things were passed by not a coalition, but two parties with a supply and confidence agreement, right, in terms of pharmacare and dental care and that kind of thing. So I am cautiously optimistic, I guess, in the face of global upheaval, that this government can at least navigate for a little bit. I'm willing to give it the benefit of a doubt, I guess.
We shall see.
Yeah, we'll see. Okay, Danny, well, do you have any final thoughts or anything about the election, the results?
I guess my final thoughts would be, you know, now that you know the election is over, that's awesome personally, but also just the fact that, you know, with the election being over, that doesn't mean us thinking about these issues that are affecting Canadians, that's not over. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe now that we do have a newly elected government, perhaps those issues that we were talking about that sort of took a back seat in this election, such as climate policy, such as housing affordability, maybe we should be thinking about that more now that voters, I'd hope, would have the capacity to.
Yeah, it's important to remember that this isn't just a once every 4 years or once every however often they call an election, that these are everyday issues that we need to be working on every day at a local and a federal level.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a quick music break, and then when we come back, we've got a story that you worked on, Danny, about new research from SFU and how BC can improve its response to extreme heat.
Yes, that was a good interview. I did that with Andrianne Doyen of SFU.
Great. Thanks for joining me, Danny. And we're going to go to Germany by Pale North.
Sounds good. We'll be right back.
Germany by Pale North here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. That's from their new record, New Nostalgia. And as mentioned, we're going to get into a story by our community reporter, Danny Nesvedarani. But before we do, I just want to tell you about a survey that is happening right now. Michael Yanni came by the station and dropped off a poster and asked us to talk about it. And we'll have a produced PSA made soon, but I just wanted to talk to you about the Sex Now Come Together survey, which is a survey to help end discriminatory organ and tissue donation policies for 2SLGBTQ plus people in Canada. It is a survey being put together by the University of Victoria and the Community-Based Research Center, along with researchers from UBC and SFU. You can go to sexnowsurvey.com, sexnowsurvey.com, to take the survey and give your input on how your experience as a 2SLGBTQ plus person has been in terms of navigating healthcare and organ and tissue donation processes. So go do that, sexnowsurvey.com. Danny, we got to get right into your interview. We have 1 minute maybe to set it up. Is there anything you think this needs contextualizing, or can we go right to it?
We can go right to it. I hope you all enjoy. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recent research study out of Simon Fraser University in Burnaby has highlighted the gaps in the province's response to extreme heat events. Spearheaded by Andrianne Doyen, associate professor at SFU's School of Resource and Environmental Management, this is the first time that BC's extreme heat response among local governments has been analyzed in a formal research study. To gain more insight on what gaps, as well as potential solutions, in BC's heat mitigation strategies that Doyen identified through this study, CJSF reached out to speak with her on the topic. During our interview, we spoke about what motivated Doyen to pursue this project, how different jurisdictions in BC can collaborate on heat mitigation, and the next steps of this research, which includes a look at the housing policy of one of the areas most affected by the extreme heat dome in the summer of 2021, Burnaby, BC.
I spent 6.5 years in Australia, and that's where I did my PhD, and then did my first academic position. And that's useful because in Australia, it gets pretty hot. So in the summer of 2021, when we were experiencing the heat dome event, I began getting a lot of requests from media asking me, can I talk about the relationship between cities and climate change? And I was like, of course I can. And, you know, obviously part of that was, well, how does heat play into it? And so, again, having this interest in cities and climate change, and then having lived somewhere where planning for heat is much more common, I was having these really great conversations and being called in. And I kept asking myself, like, you know, what else should I be doing? But also, like, what research is missing? What does it look like to ask questions within our region that has historically not experienced a lot of extreme heat events? So thinking about our relatively temperate climate here, you know, in Vancouver, but in the Pacific Northwest as well. So I was really interested in, you know, after surviving the summer of 2021, I was like, I want to study heat here. I really want to know what's happening, and then how can we improve our preparedness and our response for future extreme heat events. So that's kind of the background where my interests and my experiences collided, and then I really wanted to see if there was something here. So I applied for a grant with the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, SHRC, and was successful in getting that money. So myself and my team of grad students began to start investigating questions around planning for extreme heat within the region.
And if you could just talk about what were some of those conclusions that you did come to, like from the research in terms of solutions regarding how BC and different jurisdictions can address extreme heat events.
Yeah, so we were really interested in understanding the role of planning. So really thinking about within that, the role or mechanisms of urban greenery, urban design, and then land use planning. So what we were seeing is that a lot of the response was public health and emergency management, which is really important, but those tend to be quite short-term in their thinking. There's a heat wave, you know, predicted next week. What are we doing about it? Whereas I'm really interested in in 10 years from now, will our neighborhoods and our houses and our cities be better prepared? So we wanted to look at that question. So what were they doing? And so when you think about what can cities or municipalities do, cities tend to be a lot hotter than naturalized environments or rural environments due to the urban heat island effect. And that is because our cities are made up of much harder surfaces. So harder surfaces and darker colors really absorb heat. We see less vegetation, which also sort of helps create more heat. And we see a lot less, you know, wind and other types of things that can move things through. So we see these really hot pockets exist in cities, but also within cities, depending on the type of development that is occurring in that density. So one mechanism, and the mechanism that is most popularly used, not only in the lower mainland here, like in Metro Vancouver, Fraser Valley, but kind of globally, is urban greenery. So it's increasing vegetation, tree cover, canopy, access to parks, and also access to what people call blue spaces. So like rivers, lakes, ponds, oceans, you know, if you live on the coast, it's cooler as well. So that's the most common response. And, you know, perhaps not surprising, it's an easy sell. Most people like trees, most people like parks. So wanting to either maintain or increase tree cover, canopy, and parks is usually something that politically is easier to sell. A lot of residents want that. Also, grand side of things, it's not the most expensive of interventions. Of course, creating a brand new park can be quite costly, but planting some trees compared to some other initiatives, you know, can be lower cost as well. So that's what we see, and we did see that here. Other interventions really focus on the more sort of standard, what we'd consider to be the built environment. So one of that is about looking at the relationship between how much hard surface estate we have and how much vegetation do we have. What types of materials are we using? We know that darker colors creates even more hotter environments. So you see places like Australia that really are pushing for people to have light colored roofs to, you know, have the exterior of their homes with lighter colors because it does help. The quality of construction of our homes makes a huge difference. So well-insulated homes help to keep your home cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter. So we know that during the heat dome, 98% of the people who lost their lives did so within residential units. So they did so within homes. So we know moving forward, much more attention needs to be provided there. Air conditioning is obviously sort of a solution that particularly the provincial government, BC Hydro, and the health authorities really responded with, and that's important, particularly within vulnerable populations, seniors, and people with existing health conditions, but it's not really a great solution long term.
The one part of the research study that I noticed talked about how different jurisdictions can sort of better collaborate when it comes to addressing extreme heat within the province. What are some of the mechanisms or strategies around that?
Well, one of the things we found is that there were, in fact, some municipalities were doing really great work, right? So we see, you know, Vancouver, Surrey, New Westminster is having a lot of really great programs and initiatives. And so part of our kind of, and this might feel like a kind of a throwaway thing, but part of wanting municipalities to collaborate is some of your neighbors might already be doing good work. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can just learn from someone who's already maybe a little bit further ahead. So really wanting, you know, municipalities to think about that. There's a lot of knowledge already in the region. Perhaps you can share and build off of that. So that's really important. The other thing is when we think about planning, at the municipal level, it's connected to the province because the province decides what is any municipality's responsibility, what powers they have, what they don't have. So there's a connection there, but there's also a connection in terms of the province will mandate or create programs to encourage municipalities to do things. And so if the province says heat is something that you need to respond to, the municipalities will respond to it. If the province isn't saying anything, then individual municipalities are really left to themselves to decide if it's something that they want to do anything about. So one of the things we looked at is every municipality in the province has complete these climate scorecards. And we were interested to see what were they putting on them. And so we did actually note that a number of them were starting to put heat as something that they were worried about. So again, but what we need is sort of top-down response from the province to kind of mainstream heat as a hazard that municipalities need to worry about, but also provide some information, some resources to help these municipalities out. Vancouver and Surrey are very well resourced. We were not surprised that they had more programs. They have huge teams, lots of capacity, and they're leaders in climate action in the province. What about the municipalities that don't have those teams, those capacity? How do they get started? So, you know, the province can play a really strong role there, and the province can also help create better relationships between the health authorities and the municipalities.
I know that your follow-up research seems to have a focus specifically within Burnaby. What have you seen so far that the municipality or city of Burnaby has done regarding heat mitigation, you know, knowing that during the 2020 heat dome, they were one of the municipalities that were most affected by the heat?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the reasons why we picked them. So they were the fourth highest death rate during the 2021 heat dome. And we, again, wanted to focus on housing because of the impact that housing had on people's survival rates. Also, City of Burnaby, and this is something that not everyone might know, it actually is really progressive in its housing policy. So throughout the region, Burnaby's doing really great things in terms of the housing policy space. So we wanted to look at this question of housing in a city that was both impacted by the extreme heat event, but also was already doing things in housing. And we wanted to see, is there a relationship between housing and heat, but also equity, because that's a big part of understanding the impacts of this. We chose Burnaby for those reasons. It's also great because we work in Burnaby, right? At SFU, that's where we're located. So it was also an opportunity to connect and work with local folks. Also, we thought Burnaby provided a bit of a context that we could learn from and think about across the province. So Burnaby, in terms of our first study of looking at, well, who is planning for heat and how, they kind of were mid-pack. They weren't doing nothing, but they weren't the best. So we also thought, as sort of a mid-pack municipality in terms of their heat response, we could hopefully find things that would be relevant for other municipalities to learn as well. So what we have found so far is something that I kind of discussed a bit earlier in terms of what the role the province could take is, in the city of Burnaby, no one owns heat. And this is something that kept coming up again and again in interviews. It's no one's responsibility. And yet a lot of staff members are doing things to respond to heat and to prepare for extreme heat events. But there's no one person, role, or department that explicitly has heat in their portfolio. It is something that social planners are working on, land use planners, emergency management, the libraries, community services. There's lots of people involved, but no one is responsible for bringing this all together or for championing heat. And that's a problem because when you need to make big decisions, when you need to bring things to council, when you want a champion, but you also want it to be, again, in someone's job description or department, because then it gets attention all year round.
The last thing that I would like to ask you is if you have any advice or recommendations for people who want to not only learn more about heat mitigation strategies, but how to advocate for them in their municipalities if they feel as if their local governments are coming short.
Yeah, I think, as you said, it is important to advocate at your local government level because they are the level of government that is the closest to you. And when it comes to you know, again, urban greenery, urban design, land use, housing policy, a lot of that comes from your municipal governments. In different, you know, municipalities that we looked at, in some of the municipalities that had really low, you know, sort of not a lot of programs or not a lot of explicit mentions of heat, we see that some of those cities are traditionally ones that have less climate action. So there is definitely a need to I think, to push that heat needs to be something that we think about, needs to be something that we think about all year round. When this paper first came out a few weeks ago, I was worried because I was like, oh no, it came out in spring, not summer. Is anyone going to care about planning for extreme heat? And people have been really receptive to it, which is really great. But that speaks to, we need to think about this all year round. We need to provide resources to it. For some, I think it's also about how you frame it. For some folks, we can think of extreme heat as a climate hazard, and we need to be thinking about our relationship to climate change in cities. For other municipalities or for other people, the way to approach this might be more on the health side, right? We want to prevent future deaths. We want to prevent future heat-related illnesses. During the heat dome, it's estimated that 5,000 to 6,000 people were impacted by heat-related illnesses in addition to the deaths, right? So it can be a heat issue. It's also a productivity issue, right? You know, I don't know if you remember, but it wasn't wonderful working conditions during these heat events as well. We think about the people working indoors, but also the people working outdoors. You know, it was unworkable conditions. So we really need to be thinking about our ability. So I would really encourage folks to think about, what is the thing that you think your council is going to be more receptive to? Is it job productivity? Is it health? Is it climate change? And really work heat into those things, because heat actually does impact all of those things.
Once again, that was Andrea Doyen, associate professor at